It is said that addiction begins as a search for healing, for wholeness, perhaps ultimately for God. But the addict gets stuck instead on the wrong thing, which only holds the prize out further and further away beyond their grasp. Who then will free us from this body of death? Hi, I'm Brian Pearson, and you are in the cave.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure. And whatever comes our way. Yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace. Fire all of your guns and pumps and explode into space. I like smoking lightning.
Welcome to the Mystic Cave, the summer edition. I'm reading from my novel, Passion Tide, published by Path Books in 2002. David has been upended by his attraction to a woman in town, made more powerful by it being both furtive and also entirely delusional. This is Chapter 5, Part 3. As the weeks passed, David grew frightened by what was happening to him. His obsession with Daphne raced through his veins like a drug, heightening his every thought and emotion, vandalizing the minutiae of his days with bold strokes and wild, vivid colors, overtaking his common sense and, along with it, the balance and order upon which so much of his life depended. Everyday tasks became charged with energy. He would overreach a glass on the counter, sending it flying to the floor. He would turn too suddenly through a doorway, cracking his shoulder against the frame. The daily ritual of shaving required such Herculean effort of self-control that he sometimes relinquished it altogether and abandoned himself to scratching at the rough stubble of several days' growth on his chin. Basic life skills were slipping away. One afternoon drive to Tofino, David ran out of gas near Long Beach and had to go knocking on doors in the native community of Isawasta until someone let him use their phone to call for help. He would forget to shop, scrounging through his empty cupboards as supper time approached, only to give up and drive over to the pen. There he would sit alone in a booth with a beer and a mock turkey platter, gazing out through his sad reflection in the window. As a last desperate measure, an antidote to this foolish lovesickness, David drew himself up and focused all his energy on the one project that remained unfinished, the food bank. He called up all the possible players and stakeholders, the town's doctor, the social workers and counselors, the Catholic priest, the evangelical pastor, the public health nurse, and anyone else he could think of who might be able to shed some light on the material needs of the town's poor and unemployed. This helped, but it still wasn't enough. When David went to get his hair cut, Randy noticed it right away. "Letting ourselves go a little, are we?" he teased, as David leaned back in the hair-washing chair. "Are we growing a beard, or are we just not shaving?" "I don't know," David mused, raising his hands to stroke his face. "How does it look?" Randy studied the patchy growth on his customer's cheeks and chin. "Too soon to tell," he said, "but it definitely changes the look. So, what's happening?" David was about to dodge the question, to be predictably circumspect about his personal life, but he suddenly realized that walls had come down, silent inner walls, and he felt no qualms now about opening up to Randy. "When did this happen?" he wondered. "Randy," he said, an excited tremor in his voice, "I think I'm in love." Really? Randy said, looking quizzically down at the middle-aged minister whose head was in his hands beneath the flow of warm water. In love, he repeated. Yes, David said, in love, hearing the words come again from his own lips. It was a strange sensation, and thrilling in a way, like allowing a dark secret out into the light where, caught now in a stunning array of hues and colors, it was even more beautiful than before. Love is meant for the light, he thought, smiling to himself. Randy was trying to take in this new information, but was having some difficulty. He was frowning as he led David over to the barber's chair. So, what does the church say about this? He asked. The church? David asked. This isn't about the church, he said, annoyance rising in his tone. This is about me. I may be ordained, but I'm still human, you know. Right, of course, Randy said. Of course you're human. But you are married, aren't you? And presumably you're not talking about being in love with your wife. Damn, David cut him off. Can't a priest have feelings like anyone else? I mean, I'm not celibate, you know. Of course not, Randy replied evenly. So what is it you're telling me? You're in love and... And, David took up the line, and I don't know. I don't really know what this means. So you're in some trouble, I would hazard a guess, Randy said. You're married, you're in love with someone else, you're a minister. In fact, you're in quite a bit of trouble, I'd say. What do you mean? David shot back. Well, think about it. Randy put his scissors down and came around to look at David directly, not through the mirror's reflection. This isn't good. We've talked before, you and I, about passion, though not exactly meaning this. Well, here it is again. What did you say? That passion has something to do with suffering? I see a lot of suffering in this scenario, my friend. Is that what you want? David dropped his eyes. He couldn't find a clear line of thought. But I'm not saying I'm going to do anything about it, he said. He felt like a squirming child caught with the cookie in his hand, but not yet actually in his mouth. Passion doesn't tend to lend itself to moral boundaries, Randy said, that's for sure. He returned to his position behind David's head and began snipping. Anytime I followed my passion, it's got me into trouble. Not that I wouldn't do it again, but I'm not married, and I'm not a minister. So be careful. That's all I'm saying. He snipped with the scissors several times in the air. Now, what do you want me to do with the back? David was annoyed by his conversation with Randy, but he had nothing to regret. He was simply talking about his feelings, something that, in this case, ought to have been met with at least some measure of encouragement. He was not talking about, well, anything, really. Lust or infidelity, nothing dangerous. They were just feelings, that was all. Everything was fine. It was not until he was driving by Daphne's cottage on his way home, slowing the car to peer through the trees to get a better look at her compound, that he realized he had walked out of Randy's shop without paying him. Okay, perhaps everything was not fine. Over the next few weeks, David concentrated on pulling together a report for the town council based on his conversations with the various community representatives. What became evident to David was a need for both a food bank and a used clothing depot, though the town doctor had disagreed. He insisted that education ought to come first, not handouts. People on limited incomes, he argued, were making bad choices, buying pop and chips and candy rather than healthy food. For his own money, he'd put effort into education, not a food bank. Others, however, had been slightly more encouraging. David categorized all the answers to his questions, assembled statistics about actual numbers and percentages of unemployed, prepared charts and graphs, and wrote and rewrote an interpretive narrative until it sounded as if he knew what he was talking about. Then he sought and was granted a place on the agenda for the next town council meeting. Town council met the following Wednesday evening. David arrived early and found his way to the council chambers, up a narrow stairwell above the town offices. He was surprised at the formality of the room's setup. It was arranged like council chambers everywhere, but all the dimensions had shrunk. The councillor's table raised and curved so that the councillors could eye one another during debate, was a half foot above the criticism of the public part of the room with its orderly rows of stacking chairs. A podium faced the long table, the place from which the public could rise when called upon to address the council. Even in Euclid, the tricky workings of democracy were being safeguarded. David shuffled his papers in his lap and reread crucial sections he planned to emphasize in his presentation. Two other members of the public joined him in the visitors section, one whom he recognized as the reporter from the local newspaper. David was overdressed, having finally shaved and put on his suit and clerical collar, but this was intentional. He wished to make an impression, even to offer a little reverse intimidation of his own. To achieve this, few things worked better than the somber look of a priest in his black suit. A door opened behind the councillor's table, and the town clerk entered. Officiously, she seated herself at one end of the councillor's table, glancing out at the public gallery over top of her reading glasses. She then began immediately taking notes, though there were, as yet, no proceedings. The door opened again, and Murray, the mayor, entered in mid-conversation with a councillor whom David did not recognize. Another councillor entered. And then, without warning, Daphne Hart appeared, taking her place among them at the table. David sucked in his breath. This was something Grace had neglected to mention. David's head dropped. He squeezed his eyes shut. Now everything was at risk. His mind raced as his carefully constructed composure slipped away. He could no longer call to mind the opening remarks he had prepared so laboriously. If he did not get hold of himself, the town's first food bank would also be its shortest lived. But even worse, any impression he might have hoped to create for Daphne was now bent out of all shape. He had not imagined, for instance, impressing her with his clerical collar and suit. Now she would see him for what he was, and not in his finest hour. Two enormous failures loomed immediately before him, one professional, one personal, and both very public. He tried concentrating on his breathing as minutes were read, motions made, reports received and tabled. He could not look up, but fixed his stare instead on the pressed creases in his pant legs. When his name was called, he felt faint, as he rose and made his way to the podium. He placed his notes on its flat surface and held on with both hands as he began to speak. His voice was swallowed by the room, but he was unable to find his inner volume control. Without looking up from his notes, he mumbled something vague about the recent downturn in the local economy, realities of which the council hardly needed reminding. He spoke of the church and its traditional care for society's most vulnerable members. He spoke of the need to do something, even if it were not specifically the food bank and clothing depot he was proposing. He referred them to the detailed report they had in front of them, and though he had prepared so much more to say, heard himself concluding his remarks, asking if perhaps they had any questions. Finally, dazed and disoriented, he allowed himself to look up. There was a general shuffling of papers as the councillors sifted through the documents before them. Finding David's, they began perusing it. Only Daphne was looking at him. He smiled thinly at her. But she appeared to be lost in thought, trying to put some pieces of a puzzle together in her mind. A councillor cleared his throat to speak. Still looking over David's document, he asked if the church was behind this, or was this David's initiative alone? The church had given its general consent, he answered, as the councillor glanced up at him. David said he would be taking council's comments back to the church before proceeding further. The councillor seemed satisfied with this. Murray addressed David now, displaying for the benefit of the room the page of appendices. He noted that there was no native representation among the people David had interviewed. Did he intend to talk to anyone from Euclid East, for instance, the reserve across the harbor? Or did David think the food bank and clothing depot would not apply to them? It was a nasty question, a line with a hook on it. David had to admit that his limited experience in this part of the world had simply prevented him from thinking of the reserve, but he would be pleased to follow up the mayor's question by contacting people from Euclid East and including their comments in a future version of his report. Murray looked up and down the table of counselors. Seeing no one else preparing to speak, he thanked David for his proposal and said the council would look forward to the updated version David would provide them, including input from the Ucluelet Band. In the meantime, he reminded David, the church was free to do whatever it wanted. But if it was seeking council's approval, that would have to wait until the proposal was complete. Council would be pleased to look at the matter again at that time. David was dismissed. He gathered up his papers and quickly left the room, making his way down the stairs and out onto the street overlooking the harbor. Mercifully, the wind and rain had let up, and David stood for a moment on the sidewalk, taking in the fresh ocean air. A door opened and closed behind him, but he hardly noticed. Then he felt a touch on his arm. He turned around and found himself looking into the dark eyes of Daphne Hart. "I just wanted to thank you for your presentation," she said. "Council isn't usually the place for encouragement, not with Murray anyway, but I really appreciate what you're trying to do. In fact, I'd like the chance to talk some more with you about it, if you have the time." David didn't know what to say. He was amazed just to find himself in her presence, there under the glow of the harbor lights. She dug into her pocket and produced a small bundle of business cards. She drew one out. "Here," she said, pressing the card into his palm. "Call me. I'd like to hear more about your plans." As he took the card from her, she reached out and touched his arm again. "I've got to go back in. But thanks again." Then she turned and was gone. The thorns tore at his clothing as David thrust himself farther into the thick bracken. His feet scrambled for a foothold in the wet undergrowth, but met only twisted roots and sudden sinkholes. He lurched forward step by clumsy step, his feet slipping beneath him. He could hear the ocean now. It was close, but the tangled bramble was too dense. He still could not reach it. When finally he gave up, he simply let his body fall forward. He was caught by the weave of the thicket, and he lay, breathing hard, propped up by the undergrowth. How hard could this be, he asked himself. The wide Pacific Ocean spread out to the western horizon, rolling on for thousands of miles, vast and uninterrupted. All he had to do was break through this narrow strip of shoreline underbrush, and he would be at the water's edge. But this was proving impossible. After his breathless encounter with Daphne Hart, David had spent a sleepless night, confused thoughts of love and loss tossing over and over with half-dreams and floating images, Beverly and Jill, themselves tossed together on an open sea of twisted sheets, Paul and Catherine in their youthful innocence knowing nothing yet possessing everything he himself now desired, so free of responsibility, so open to an unwritten future. Finally, he had risen, splashed water on his face, checked the clock, and realized he wasn't going to sleep at all. He made himself some coffee and took it up to the attic, where he gazed out at the coming dawn. He had tried all morning to get some work done, poring over the readings for the coming Sunday, but he couldn't hold a single thought in his head for more than a few seconds at a time. He'd say to himself, "Okay, we're dealing here with..." And then he'd realize he had just read an entire passage without having a clue what it was dealing with. So he'd go back and start over, only once again to lose his concentration halfway through. He was getting nowhere. By afternoon, he had given up trying to make any headway on anything remotely approximating work. He should lie down, he thought, catch up on the sleep he'd lost. But by now he had drunk far too much coffee, and his body was buzzing with electric energy. His hand trembled as he stroked the stubble of a new day's growth of beard. He had headed out in the Frog Prince to make a fresh assault on the blowhole, determined either to break through to the shoreline or to exhaust himself trying. He managed only to achieve the latter. At the fork in the road, under its tall, dead cedar guardian, David had followed the trail to the left, just as Cecil had said, tramping through runoff water that sloshed up over the tops of his boots. When the trail narrowed and there was still no sign of a path leading down to the shore, he had simply plunged himself headfirst into the thick underbrush, intent on blazing his own trail to the sea. The forest had another idea, however, and now, in small consolation, it supported his weight with its matted branches, twisted and thorny, rather than swallowing him whole. He yielded completely, his energy spent, letting his body go limp while his head took stock of the situation. He was a faithful family man, a priest in the Church of God, a man of integrity. What was he doing now flirting with danger, opening himself to a tempest that could sweep him away forever from everything he knew and loved? Did he think he was somehow immune to the consequences of irresponsible behavior? If he pursued this thing with Daphne, was he really prepared to lose everything? No, he had to take hold of himself. He had to get his feet back on the ground. He had to return everything to its proper perspective. He had only 6 weeks left now in his stay on the coast. That was all the time he had to keep at bay the terrifying temptations to begin putting things back in their place, and then to return to his life. He was too close. He could not afford to blow it now. Slowly, he extricated himself from the thick bramble, backing through the small tunnel of broken twigs and branches he had created. His feet finally found something that felt half solid. It was the soggy path from which he had made this mad lunge toward the sound of the surf. He stood upright, brushed himself off, and turned away from the ocean, passing beneath its ghostly cedar guardian, making his way back to the Frog Prince and home. He would have to do something. Inner resolve was not enough. He needed some sort of symbolic action to free himself from these demon temptations. He recalled something he had learned from Dean Barber's workshop on stress management. Sometimes it is helpful to write things down, she had said, to compose a letter, to get the feelings out, and so to put distance between ourselves and our demons. He considered this. It could be a therapeutic letter, not real correspondence, something tangible he could then offer up in prayer, burning it, perhaps, like incense, or letting the angry riptides of the ocean carry it away. He got home, exchanged his wet clothes for sweats, sat down at his desk, and pulled out a pad of paper. He sat for a long time, unsure how to begin. He got up and paced the house up and down, trying to formulate his confusion of thoughts and feelings. What was it exactly he was required to sacrifice to the gods in return for his peace of mind? It was turning to late afternoon, but the low February sun was working to penetrate the cloud cover. The wet season was ending. Soon the sun would succeed, and crocuses would start poking up through the soft earth. There was something he had to bury in the soaked sod of winter, something to leave behind as springtime now drew him forward to the life he had left at home. He found himself in the kitchen, still unsure how to start, but determined to break through. He reached above the refrigerator for the bottle of Lafroig. Maybe a wee dram would inspire him. He dropped a few ice cubes into a glass and poured himself a healthy shot, then added a splash of water. He carried it down to the study and sat again at the desk. He picked up his pen. "Dear Daphne," he wrote, surprised to see her name on paper. He sipped at the whiskey. He looked out the window. "Dear Daphne," he said aloud, dreamily, excited by the sound of her name on his lips. "Thank you for your kindness to me the other evening at the town council meeting." He called to mind the touch of her hand upon his arm, her consoling words, her dark eyes looking with such understanding, with such compassion into his own. He took another sip. Again, he put pen to paper. "I'm afraid my presentation was not what I had intended it to be. The issue of unemployment is important to me, but I failed to do it justice. I suppose it was just nerves, but I left feeling that I had made a botch of the whole thing." True, he thought. That's exactly how he had felt. This was good, this confession. He took another sip, inspired now to probe deeper. "The thing is, I have wanted in every ministry I have had to make my mark. It's something I learned from my father, who was also a priest, and he never failed to make his mark wherever he was, whatever he did. So it might be true to say that, in spite of my good intentions, my motives were mixed. I am concerned with the plight of those who struggle with poverty. I am moved by their victimization, by economic forces over which they have no control. But, truth be told, I am equally moved by the thought of my passing through this town, or through this life for that matter, unnoticed. I want to make a difference, but also I want to be seen to make a difference." He leaned back and reread what he had written. "True," he said to himself, "all too true." He turned on the desk lamp against the descending dark and took another sip of the whiskey. He pressed on. "My sense of failure, then, had as much to do with failing to make my mark as it did with disappointing the hopes of those who might have benefited from a food bank or a used clothing depot. I hate to admit this, but it is nonetheless true. I am not the good man I want to be. But it will soon be Lent, the season of repentance. My confession is made in faith that new life will spring from it." A little too ecclesiastical, he thought. A little too dramatic. But what did it matter? He wasn't sending the letter anyway. He went upstairs and refilled his glass, this time adding the ice but not the water. He returned to the next matter at hand. "In fact, this whole trip, this whole adventure, has been about me. I have been moved not by concern for others, but concern for myself. My wife had an affair with a woman. Did I care to find out what had led her to do this? No, I did not. Did I listen to her when she tried to share with me her own pain and confusion? No, I did not. I turned and ran away. I came out here. Caring for the people of my new parish was not even part of my intention. Even today, I hardly know their names." David suddenly remembered his first Sunday up at St. Columba's in Tofino and the deaf lady arranging flowers on the altar. He had not given her another thought, even as the weeks went by and she never again showed herself in church. He did not ask anyone who she was or what she had been doing. She had simply slipped beneath his notice, outside the blinkered vision of his own selfish concern. He raised the glass to his lips and took another drink. The pungent smack of the whiskey did not bother him now. Even its burning bitterness slid down his throat with ease. "So, Daphne, when you followed me out from the meeting offering me encouragement, it meant far more to me than you could have known. It was like a sweet balm, a salve for a wound that had been festering for some time, perhaps all my life. It was like forgiveness. It was like, in spite of my selfishness, in spite of everything, someone still cared enough about me to do what you did, to touch my arm, to look into my eyes and say, 'It's okay. Everything is going to be all right.'" Tears came to David's eyes now as he wrote these words. "Everything would be all right," he repeated to himself. "Everything would be all right." He sniffed, wiped his eyes, and took another drink of the scotch, replacing the glass roughly on the desk, the whiskey splashing up and onto the paper. He blotted it dry with the cuff of his sleeve and carried on. "But that's not all I want to say. I want to say, too, that something has happened to me that is at once both the most exciting and the most terrifying thing I've ever known." He gulped down the scotch. "I have fallen in love, hopelessly in love, with you. Please don't be taken aback by this. It probably happens to you all the time, but not to me. From the first moment I saw you at the Christmas concert, I have been unable to think of anyone or anything else. Watching you give yourself to that performance with such serenity and grace, so lovely in the soft glow of the stage lights, I fell in love with you in an instant, and I've not been the same since." He wiped his mouth with the back of his sleeve. "Onward. When I saw you at the restaurant, I just about went out of my skin. Though trying to appear aloof and self-controlled, I attended to your every move and gesture. You chose sweet vermouth as an aperitif. You ordered the halibut. You hold your fork in your left hand. You sweep the bangs from your forehead with your right. You see, I was completely swallowed up by your presence there. I was barely able to remain in my seat with the bishop and his wife going on about something or other. I don't even know what. You were my entire universe that evening, Daphne." "True. All true. I would ask your forgiveness, but what is there to forgive? Passion knows no morals, no ethical standards, no bounds of any kind. It just sweeps you away. And Daphne, I have been swept away by you." David leaned back in his chair to consider the words on the page, but losing his balance, he had to make a fast grab for the edge of the desk to catch himself from falling backward. The room was beginning to spin. He rose and placed both hands on the surface of the desk to steady himself. He turned and climbed the stairs to the kitchen, snatched the bottle of whiskey by the neck, and brought it back down with him to the study. Pouring himself another glass, this time with neither ice nor water, he placed the bottle within reach, took a gulp from the glass, and returned to his confession. "And now, what I should be saying is that I can never see you again, that I cannot allow myself to search your eyes, your wonderful, lively eyes, in hope that perhaps there was more to your touch on my arm than the desire to console the miserable presenter of an embarrassing report. But, my love, I do hope. I cannot help but hope. If I could not hope, I would be but a walking dead man. So, Daphne, tell me you love me too. Tell me everything's going to be all right. Tell me I am not a fool. Tell me..." David trailed off. He couldn't think what else he wanted her to tell him. He took a swig right from the bottle. He signed the letter, more a child scribbled than anything resembling a signature, stuffed it in an envelope, and wrote her name on it. He sat for a moment looking at the envelope on his desk. There was something he should be thinking about, but he couldn't remember what. He picked up the envelope, walked unsteadily out of the room and up the stairs, holding on to the handrail. He saw his car keys in their little dish on the kitchen counter. He wondered if he was forgetting something. He scooped up the keys and walked out the door. He got himself into the Frog Prince and drove to the post office without thinking to turn the headlights on, weaving in and out of the circles of light cast by each street lamp. There he stood, rocking on his heels in front of the mailbox. An alarm bell seemed to be ringing somewhere. An inner voice, very deep and far away, was shouting at him, "Hey, what do you think you're doing? Stop it! Stop right there!" He pulled open the hatch and dropped the letter inside. As the sprung door slammed shut, he stood for a moment, trying to focus on a thought. What is it he had just done? He had told the truth, for once in his life. It's just the truth, that's all, the truth. And he got into the Frog Prince and wove his way home through the darkness. We were born to be wild. We can climb so high. I never wanna die. I've been reading from my novel Passion Tide. Next time, as his time on the coast draws to a close, David is forced to consider the consequences of his actions, as indeed we all must. Things may work out for him after all. But then again, I'm Brian Pearson. You've been listening to The Mystic Cave.